My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. As a young teenager, A.R. Roberts lived near an Air Force base where odd things happened on a regular basis. One night, he and some local newscasters witnessed a UFO, and the experience remained with him throughout his life. 33 years later, he began his 23-year quest for answers, culminating in his groundbreaking 2012 book, From Atom to Omega, An Anatomy of UFO Phenomenon. He joins me this week on Destination Unlimited to share the revised and updated edition of his book with evidence of how human interaction with ETs has shaped humanity from the earliest times and impacts our day-to-day life. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Alan A.R. Roberts. Good evening, Alan.
Good evening, Victor.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your amazing stories.
That's what I'm here for.
Alan, let's start with your early years and your love of music. How did that evolve?
I started playing guitar when I was like 14 years old. And by the time I was 16, I was in a local band. We were playing school dances, YMCA dances. And I graduated up to another band when I was 17 or 18. And we were playing actual clubs around the area and northern New York State. The southern part of Quebec and over in Vermont, right across, we were in Plattsburgh, New York, right across the lake from Vermont, Lake Champlain. That band, eventually we ran into a singer-comedian who played the high-end circuit, Las Vegas, New York, Lake Tahoe, and she was interested in doing, creating an act, and instead of being a solo singer and comedian, she wanted to do an act, and she needed a backup band, and she chose us. Then we went to Montreal. Her husband owned a club up there, and we spent 3 months putting together the act there. Her name was Sandu Scott, and the act was called Sandu Scott and the Scotties. We opened at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Montreal. That first week we were there, actually, we signed a contract to do the Ed Sullivan Show in December of that year. It was 1964. So after Montreal, we went to Quebec City for 2 weeks, big gig there, and then on to New York, where we spent 3 weeks rehearsing with the sound crew, the light crew, and the stage crew at the Latin Quarter. And we were the star act there for that summer. Actually, we were supposed to be there for 2 weeks and then go to Lake Tahoe. On our closing night, they made the announcement that they're bringing us back for an unprecedented in the history of the Latin Quarter. Sandu Scott and the Scotties will be back for another 4 weeks. And so we had 2 weeks off because of Letterman, very famous vocal group back then, were in for 2 weeks. And then we went back for the 4 weeks. It was crazy because we were staying at the Oliver Cromwell Hotel Apartments on 72nd Street West, just off Central Park. Maureen O'Sullivan, who played the old Tarzan, Jane, in the old Tarzan movies with Johnny Weissmuller, she lived upstairs from us. We never knew who she was. We rode up and down the elevator with her several times, but we found out who she was, as Mia Farrow's mother. You know. And anyway, Sandu kept us broke because all this time we had to pay for all of this stuff, and she's the one that chose the places where we would stay. And of course, being out of work for like 3 weeks there kind of put us in hock. So we decided this wasn't for us, and we ended up leaving. But we got a group we found over in New Jersey to take our place. Anyway, she was promising them, you know, they went to Las Vegas and the Desert Inn, and they were. She was promising them, oh, they're going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show in December. But she didn't read the fine print in the contract because it called for the original group as it was auditioned, which meant we had to go back with her in December to do the Ed Sullivan Show. And that group that she had with her, they left. They got really ticked off. And they ended up doing very well. They became well known as the Young Rascals.
Oh, yes.
They had a lot of hit records there back in the 60s. And then after that, you know, I went with a group called Freddie and the Freeloaders, and we had an agent who kept us pretty busy traveling around the country. And that was, I left the business in 1968. I got tired of living out of a suitcase. And the fact that I was never home, I was married with four kids. And my wife, she couldn't take it anymore. So, you know, unfortunately, we ended up getting divorced around 1965. And I can't blame her, because, you know, being married and being on the road like that, it's not conducive to a happy marriage. So that's how it went. And then I got into the hotel business for a while, and I had a hobby of photography that I ended up opening a very successful studio up in Pennsylvania. I was there for like 15 years. It was going good until the economy went down the tubes and they raised school taxes and property taxes on 15%, 17% in 1 year. And my business dropped by 50% in 1 year. People were moving out of the county, and oh my God, it was terrible. All half of every other downtown store was boarded up. And I decided, well, I'm going to get off the boat Port Saints. And some of my old musician friends were down here in Florida, so I decided to come down and join them. And that's where I had time. I ended up writing four books on the UFO subject.
Now, in 1954, while still in your teens, you joined the Ground Observer Corps. What did they do, and how did you participate?
Well, it was an Air Force program designed to reduce the threat of an air attack from the former Soviet Union. And there was just a series of posts located around the country where all the observers' duty was to report by telephone to a filter center every aircraft flying over the area. And it was, you know, a fairly simple thing. And I would go up on Friday nights. Now, I was still in high school then, and had my mother's permission, and I'd stay until after dawn. Most of the time, very rarely did I leave before dawn. But yeah, things were a lot safer back then, and you know, it was a whole different era back then. It was 1954. It was 1955. Our post was on the roof of Physicians Hospital. It's the highest point in the city of Plattsburgh, and Plattsburgh was right on Lake Champlain, right directly across from Vermont. And they were building a new Air Force base at the south end of town. Now, this was 1955. I'd been in there about a year in the Corps. And while they were building this base, people all over town started reporting, seeing UFOs and flying saucers and all kinds of weird things in the sky. And there were two gentlemen from a local radio station, Jim Roddy and Art Pierce. Now, Jim was the news director of WEAV Radio, and Art Pierce was the newscaster. And they'd come up several times during the week, and they'd always come up on Friday nights when I was there. And they were hoping to see something for themselves. And one, the most memorable thing, I'd seen quite a few things that, during my watch that I couldn't explain, but I hesitated on reporting a lot of it because we were getting some negative publicity, and people thought we were drinking, you know, and their eyes rolled up whenever they heard one of these stories. So, but they came up one Friday night, and they saw something that really blew their mind. Now, I didn't see it. I was on the phone inside the post calling in a routine aircraft report. And they saw this light erratically descend into the glare of the construction lights at the south end of the city. And at that point is where they were laying their runways for this new Air Force base. Well, I got off the phone. They were adamant that something come down over there. I thought they were just kidding around at first, but no, they were serious and they wanted to go and check it out. And we had gotten to know each other pretty well over the weeks, and they invited me to go along if I was interested. Well, they had my curiosity piqued, so I put the post out of operation and went with them. And the nearest we could get to the area was this dirt road. They'd just cut through the woods. It was going to skirt the northern right at the northern edge of this Air Force base, right where the runways would begin. Now, eventually, this dirt road would be a main artery connecting the southeast to the southwest corner of town. But right now, it was just muddy, bumpy ruts, and the car was bouncing like crazy and couldn't drive maybe 4 or 5 miles an hour to keep from damaging the car. We came to a clearing. Apparently, that's where they had parked some of the equipment they'd used to open up the road. And Jim says, well, I'm going to get up on the roof of the car and see if I can spot a local city light over the trees and give us an idea of exactly where we are. Well, the trees were too high. He couldn't see anything. So he got down and said, well, we'll go a little farther down the road if we don't see anything. Now and then we'll go back to the post. Well, just as we were ready to get back in the car, we all looked up. Right over our heads was this huge, glowing, white, oval-shaped thing. It seemed to be dripping or emitting sparks. And it was not a sound. It was just barely skimming over the treetops. And it was huge. And it not a sound. It moved very slowly. And we had it in sight for, I guess, 5, 6, 7 seconds before it disappeared over the trees. And Jim, I think it was Jim that said, did you see that? Yeah, we did. Well, we got back in the car and headed back to the post. But this thing indelibly burned, the impression of it was indelibly burned into my brain. And I could not forget it. And it bugged me for 33 years. It was 1988. I guess it was when I decided I'll do some research on this subject and see if I can figure out what it was that we saw that night. Now, once I started the research, I figured out a couple of weeks, a couple of months tops, I'll probably be able to figure out what it was. I never really knew how complex an issue the UFO phenomenon was. And once I got into it, that research ended up lasting 23 years, which resulted in the very first book that I wrote, which is the current book is actually an updated and revised edition of that book, because a lot of that information back then, it came out in 2012, but a lot of that information is now pretty much obsolete, and a lot of new details, a lot of new information has come to light, which I've incorporated into the new book, and I think explains a lot more than the original book did. So, I mean, that's how I got started into the thing, and you know, from that point on, my research continued. I've got an extraordinary the volume of I started doing it on recording on VCR tapes, VCH tapes. But over the years, I had more tapes than my bookcase could handle, and that's when they started coming out with DVDs and recording machines that would record DVDs. So I ended up 6 months, or it took me over 6 months to transfer all those files over to DVD recordings. And then from then on, I just kept continued recording. Plus, you know, I got a lot of information from books and other research in other areas as well.
This book is absolutely a masterwork. It's more than 500 pages of your research over all these years. When you started, did you approach this from the standpoint of a believer or a skeptic?
Well, I won't say I was a skeptic. I believe there was something there. I saw it myself, but I didn't know for sure what it was. I couldn't prove it was an extraterrestrial spaceship. And there was always a possibility, gee, it could have been some kind of weather anomaly that I wasn't familiar with. But, you know, over the years, the more I read and learned about the subject and the fact that this happened right near the construction of a new Air Force base, too many little things started to, you know, convince me that the subject is real, UFOs are real. I say that because I saw one. Other paranormal anomalies like ghosts and poltergeists and all that, I never saw a ghost, so I'm a little more critical in that area, but my mind is open.
Absolutely. So getting back to your original sighting, let's talk about that for a second. You described it as oval. You described it as, did you say like a luminescent type glow to it?
Yeah, it was just a brilliant white glowing thing. It was like it was just like a light, but it was oval shaped and it was emitting or dripping sparks.
Now, the stuff that was emitting or dripping, you described them as sparks. Was there any residue left behind or anything of that nature?
The sparks dissipated. Just, you know, and you'd see it fall off this object, but then it would just they just immediately disappear or dissipate. You know?
So, other than the visual impact, did you feel or sense anything?
Well, the strange thing that at the time, it seemed like what I described in the first book, it seemed like everything was happening in slow motion, but not really. And I didn't know how to describe that, except I just said the perceptual distortion. Now, it could be that we were just too awestruck at the moment at what we were seeing. And, you can, in a way, I suppose that could contribute to making it seem like it was everything was in slow motion. But I don't know. It's just a weird feeling. Everything was normal after it disappeared. And the thing is, on the way back to the observation tower, none of us said a word. The three of us drove in total silence, and it took about 20 minutes to drive back to the where the observation post was. And we were about halfway back there before anybody even had the thought of saying anything. I mean, all we could do is, well, what the hell was that? You know.
And you didn't have any sense of lost time? There were no coordinations on watches or lack of timekeeping?
No, I mentioned in the first book, I said that kind of thing is kind of indicative of what people report in abduction cases. But I said this is long before anybody ever heard of abductions. And no, there was no missing time, so I'm sure we weren't abducted or anything like that.
In the original From Adam to Omega, it's been described as the best researched and most comprehensive book on the UFO phenomenon. What approach did you take to this meticulous and thorough research?
Well, I just simply started out by just doing research on sightings. But that research kind of led me into other areas. You know, I started to get alien abductions, for example. And then there were so many other elements that seemed to fit into it. You've got the crop circles, cattle mutilations, Bigfoot. I mean, so many elements that were associated with it. And I tried to be objective and separate the wheat from the chaff. And I kind of, even in the second book, I included what I thought was relevant and irrelevant in those different facets of the subject, but I keep an open mind, you know, crop circles, and I think there's a very good possibility now. I wasn't so 100% sure back then. The crop circles, there's a very good possibility they have something to do with it. And I don't know. Once I got into it, like I said, I got quite an education. I mean, I got into Egyptology, ancient civilizations, science, astronomy, paleontology, I mean, all kinds of things. And I guess it blew my mind. But what really got me the most is when it eventually led into biblical history.
And we're actually going to talk about that in our next segment. My guest is Alan A. R. Roberts. His book is entitled From Adam to Omega, An Anatomy of UFO Phenomena. It's the revised and new updated edition. Alan, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Well, the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and cracking about almost any book website on the internet. And you can check out my website. It's arroberts.net.
And we'll be back with more of Alan after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
The best of the holistic, spiritual, and conscious world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. a philanthropic organization. Their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going OM? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad? Your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Imagine yourself being transported to India, to the banks of the Ganga and an ashram in Rishikesh. Visualize that you are welcome to satsang with an American sannyasi who shares the wisdom of her guru. Your visualization has manifested. Join Satvi Bhagavati Saraswati for inspiration and transformation every Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio.
Birthday parties. Getting back to the moments we miss starts with getting informed. Get the latest info about COVID-19 vaccines at getvaccineanswers.org. It's up to you. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week is Alan A.R. Roberts. His book, From Atom to Omega, An Anatomy of UFO Phenomenon. So, as your title implies, your research begins with ancient civilizations. What were some of your findings?
Well, I was curious about a lot of these petroglyphs, ancient petroglyphs that these prehistoric people drew on rocks and cave walls. That a lot of them were showing oval shapes, diamond shapes, triangular shapes, and there were a lot of depictions of weird-looking people, if you want to call them that. They didn't seem to be drawing what they felt was people. Okay, some of them were wearing costumes or spacesuits and. Over in Valcamonica, Italy, there's a 10,000-year-old petroglyph over there. It looks like two astronauts in spacesuits holding strange objects in their hand. That blew my mind. And, you know, there were so many other things. Out in California, in the Death Valley region, there was several petroglyphs of sine wave patterns drawn by prehistoric, ancient Indians that were living in that area. Now, sine wave patterns are only produced on an oscilloscope, and these petroglyphs are thousands of years old. How would ancient Indians know of sine wave patterns? There's a legend is that they saw two objects collide in the sky. One of them crash landed near Mustard Canyon. And they watched people came down, I would assume, in another craft to repair the damaged vehicle. And apparently they were using something on akin to an oscilloscope if they saw these patterns emerge. Now there's two other glyphs there at the same location showing what looks like a bowl-shaped craft that seems to depict structural damage. And then there's another one right alongside of it that depicts a very similar vehicle. It seems to be pretty much intact in structure. So were they drawing or were they creating images of the vehicle that crashed and the one that carrying the men that came down to repair it? And that kind of blew my mind. And there's so many of these things that, you know, throughout the thing. But it's really mind-boggling, especially when you get into some of the technology, ancient technologies. You look at these structures that were built with specifications that we can't duplicate today with our technology. Well, take like over in Pumapunku or in Tiwanaku in Bolivia, Sacsayhuaman over there. You've got Baalbek in Lebanon. Some of the blocks at the Temple of Jupiter and that complex there and the walls, some of those blocks weigh in excess of 1,000 tons. And there's two at the quarry. One, they believe, is like over 1,300 tons in weight. And there's another one they just uncovered. This may weigh over 1,600 tons. How the heck could they move these things? We don't have anything in the world that could possibly move or even lift anything like that. Yet these people seem to have been able to do it. But how? That sort of thing is really mind-boggling.
Now, you also started talking in the last segment at the end there about the Bible. Does the Hebrew Bible reveal evidence of extraterrestrial visitation, and how were you able to come to that conclusion?
Well, one of the first things I noticed once I get into the Bible, right in the very beginning, I think it's Genesis 3:4, I forget the exact passage number. Adam and Eve were evicted from the Garden of Eden, and it says, cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth was installed at the entrance to Eden to prevent them further access to the Tree of Life, which was allegedly the source of their longevity. Well, I'm thinking, this thing that they, flaming sword flashing back and forth, that sounds like a mechanical device with moving parts. And we have basically the same thing today. A laser device used for security has a sweeping or scanning laser beam. Well, that was just one thing. But then when we got further on into the Bible and even into the New Testament, I noticed these angels always seem to appear out of a brilliant light or a brilliant flash of light. I said, my God, that sounds exactly what abductees are describing, how these little gray guys appear out of a brilliant light in their bedroom at night. Or they seem like they come through the wall, but there's usually a flash of light or a bright light involved. I said, could there be anything? It sounds like teleportation. And when you look at the angel that appeared in Peter's locked prison cell in the Bible, there's this angel appeared out of a brilliant flash of light in his locked prison cell. Then you've got the transfiguration of Christ. Now, it says he was engulfed in his brilliant light, but that happened at the exact same moment that it says Moses and Elijah appeared standing or materialized right next to him. So it was his transfiguration. Was he really engulfed in the brilliant light of this teleportation beam that delivered Moses and Elijah to his side? You know, there's a question. I can't say that was what really happened, but you know, when you look at all these stories, it seems to make sense. And there's so many other clues to other technologies in the Bible besides teleportation. You got replication, force fields. You got all kinds of weird things in there. Laser weapons or beams, laser beams.
What about the Ark of the Covenant?
Now, that I think has been misrepresented in a lot of stories. They claim it can fly through the air, can shoot beams at enemy forces, and you know, take over in wartime. It could do all these things to the enemy. But if you look in the very beginning when Moses received instructions on how to build the Ark of the Covenant, it suggests that it was built strictly to provide communication between Moses and this being called the Lord. And I've quoted several passages in my book there where this took place. I don't believe it had any other special powers other than I think it was just a biblical two-way radio. That's how Moses communicated with the Lord in the tent of meeting. Other times before the tent meeting was even constructed, apparently the Lord would beam down and talk to him face to face. And he and his brother Aaron and probably Joshua, and there might have been a couple other people involved that actually ever saw this being in person. But just before the Exodus, before they started to left Egypt, that's when he started appearing in a cloud where nobody could see him, even though they may have heard his voice, possibly. But he would always stay hidden in a cloud from that point on, right up in through the... to the ascension of Christ. And so and there's so much in the Bible. I mean, it just blew my mind. And there's other very good indications that human hybrids were created in the Bible. And I cite comparisons to the alien breeding program going on today. Now, what we know about alien abductions, basically, is women are usually abducted during their fertile period when they're ovulating, and the aliens are collecting their eggs. With men, their abductions appear to be random, but among the most obvious things they seem to be doing with men is collecting sperm. Now, what seems to be happening, this is my theory, is that they're doing modification in the DNA in the sperm that they collect from male subject, probably enhancing certain elements. And they fertilize these men's sperm with the eggs. They fertilize it in vitro on their ship. Now, there's two elements to this. They abduct the women again and inseminate them with this fertilized egg. And usually within 3 months, right around the end of the first trimester, they abduct the women again and extract the fetus from their wombs. Now, I say there's two elements that I could read into this. One is they're creating hybrids for experimentation on their ship. The other is they're creating hybrids, human hybrids, to be born into our society. And how do I know this? Well, Dr. David Jacobs, a retired history professor from Temple University, is probably one of the, today, probably one of the foremost authorities on alien abductions. And one of the women that he worked with said she managed to ask these aliens, why are you taking our babies? Why are you taking us? And she was told, we only take those that we need. Well, what does that tell you? We're not taking them all. Which means that some of them are being born into our society. Now, are they the ones that are have genetically enhanced talents that maybe in the area of science or even music? There's so many elements to this. And they why are they creating a hybrid? Well, the thing, the point is here, it's a good case to prove alien abductions, because these women, they claim they were very, very careful using birth control, and many of them said they were not even sexually active at the time that they became pregnant. Well, so we know that some of these hybrids are being born into our society today. But why are they doing this? And see, that presents a whole other question. But the whole premise of the book is that apparently, from what I gather, there's probably several species of aliens that are involved. And in fact, the government may even be involved with some of them. But I focus on two particular ones, these little grays that usually involved with the abductions, although reptilians are sometimes involved. But these little grays and a certain species of the, what they call the Nordics, are very human looking. And they seem to be the ones that were evolved during the biblical era. And I cite the case of Travis Walton as one of the cases that seemed to be very credible, where he encountered both the human-looking aliens and these little grays. But
let me touch upon that for a second. There are many who share terror in these experiences, and other who found them pleasant and educational, and I count myself in that second group, as I explained to you in our off time during my childhood. Why do you think there's this dichotomy?
I don't know for sure. David Jacobs wrote a third book called Walking Among Us, I think the title was. And he goes into quite a bit of detail about these various types of aliens. Some seem to be friendly, some seem not to be so friendly. And in fact, I have part of one chapter in the book dealing with the hostile factor. But the majority of them seem to be, indifferent, if you want to call it that. They're not hostile and they're not overly friendly. They're just apathetic in many cases. But I think if you really want to learn more about what goes on with these different types of aliens, if you read Jacob's third book there, you know, Walking Among Us, he answers a lot of those questions. But the thing that got me, that kind of rather proves the abduction part of it, is the doctors that were treating these women. Now, these women, when they first started having vague or fragmented memories, and they started having nightmares, and ones that could afford it would go, seek professional help, a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and then they'd use regressive hypnosis to get into the root of the problem. Now, there's a lot of arguments about how reliable hypnosis is, but the fact that most of these cases are so similar, I mean, even in the tiny little trivial details, like oh, what color was the wastebasket in the corner of the room? Not that there was a wastebasket there, but you know, I'm just using that as an example. Too many similarities kind of rule out the idea that these things are made up. Now, these women, according to their doctors, suddenly turned up not pregnant. Now, it's confirmed by their gynecologist. They did not have a miscarriage. They did not have an abortion. And they were not cases of pseudocyesis, the medical term for false pregnancies. They had a fetus in their womb. It suddenly disappeared. And one doctor said, well, once he couldn't, it blew his mind. He went to clean the womb of this young lady and found that the womb had already been cleaned. So it's mind-boggling. So in that case, I mean, these pregnancies were confirmed by the doctors. Why did they suddenly disappear?
That's a great question. My guest, Alan A.R. Roberts, his book, From Adam to Omega, An Anatomy of UFO Phenomena. We'll be back with more of Alan after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese. And guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this week, Alan A.R. Roberts, his book, From Adam to Omega, An Anatomy of UFO Phenomena. So what's your take on 20th century government denial and obfuscation?
Well, back in the 1970s, these little gray guys would tell the people they abducted. They would show them scenes on some kind of a screen, or maybe inject infuse visions in their mind of apocalyptic devastation. I mean, and they were telling them that what you're seeing is really going to happen. So apparently there's some kind of a doomsday prediction. And when I started to connect all the dots, I started, especially in the biblical narrative, it seems to be that there's a deadline involved. In other words, they're preparing us to be able to save ourselves whenever this disaster is going to happen, which in all probability, it's not going to be in our lifetime. Maybe later on in this millennium or the next, or even the next millennium, who knows? But there's a deadline, and in the beginning, when Adam broke the rules by eating, supposedly eating the forbidden fruit, blah, 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 there, it seemed like, why were they creating, why did they create Adam and Eve? Well, my impression was they were created to infuse updated genetic qualities into the existing population. Because mankind had been around for thousands of years before the biblical timeline that they say Adam and Eve was created, which is roughly 4,000 BC, about 6,000 years ago. But getting into modern times, they put the project on hold for about 2,000 years until Isaac, who I believe was a hybrid, born to Sarah, was elderly and sterile, was created, and Isaac was the progenitor of the new race. Now, and it was his descendants that ended up becoming, the Hebrew population, the Israelites. But 2,000 years had elapsed before that had happened. And it was like 2,000 years I had to make up for. And my impression is that they got made up for this 2,000 years right at the beginning of the 20th century. Oh, you got Ford, the Wright brothers, Tesla, all these inventions, Albert Einstein, the greatest minds and the greatest, all the technology we depend on today was created right during that time period in the first half of the 20th century, to the point where we were able to put a man on the moon in 1969. But at the same time, these same inventions were being created by other people. And I put their names in the book to the other people that were involved with these same inventions at the same time. In fact, before Henry Ford started his the Ford Motor Company, what was it, 1919? I forgot what year it was. Anyway, a fellow by the name of, I forgot his first name, Benz, not Mercedes-Benz, but his name was Benz. He had already invented the very first
internal combustion,
gasoline-powered.
Yeah.
So and it seems to me like they caught up for that 2,000 years right around that time. Now, today, you've got all these UFO incursions at missile sites and nuclear missile bases where they've rendered dozens of missiles useless at these locations. In fact, in many cases, they've actually activated the launch codes, which scared the hell out of the guys in the underground launch facilities. But they never let the missiles launch. That's another thing. And then you probably heard about the one over in the Ukraine in Bialykarivi, I can't pronounce the name of that town, where these UFOs are hovering over the missile site, and then this huge 900-foot-long wide disc was hovering over the area, and down in the bunker, all of a sudden the missiles went into launch mode, and it lasted for about 15 seconds. I can imagine these guys were probably had to change their pants after this thing was over, because it looked like World War III was about ready to start, and there's nothing they could do to stop it. And so what are they're telling us? They're not very happy with our missiles, our weapons of mass destruction. In fact, I don't know if you've heard of this part of the Rendlesham Forest incident. You're familiar with that one?
Yes, absolutely.
When the night that Colonel Holt was out there with his team, they saw this one craft came up, hovered above their heads, and shined a pencil-thin beam of laser light down at their feet. And then it shot back across the sky and was over the weapons storage area, shining beams of light down there. And what most people don't know about that incident is when they inspected that area, they discovered one of these beams had burned a hole through the roof of a bunker storing a nuclear weapon. It didn't hit the weapon. If it had, it would have been a nuclear disaster. But what are they telling us? I mean, they're warning us, I think, that we got to keep these things in check or get rid of them. I imagine they have the technology to neutralize every nuclear weapon on the planet. But, you know, when you look at from their perspective, it would be pointless, because they cannot... develop the wisdom for us. That's something that we have to develop. And I think that's what they're trying to do at this stage of the game. In fact, it looks like their agenda has been put on temporary hold. I mean, after we went to the moon, all the technology, after we learned how to split the atom, the very first thing we did was create a weapon of mass destruction and use it in a war against another nation, which, you know, it ended the war, but
in a very horrible way. Let me ask you this. There are those who say that not only do governments have recovered ET technology, but they've also back-engineered and built craft. And some of the sightings that we're having now are actually ours. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. Especially these large triangular craft. They seem to be too their appearances are way too frequent over military installations or around them. So it's either the aliens are keeping track of our nuclear installations or else they belong to us and they're coming from these places. But and it's funny. And when you go back to the Roswell event, now a lot of people don't know the truth about Roswell. Lieutenant Hout was the public information officer at the base, and he was worked very closely with Colonel Blanchard, the base commander. He created a sealed, notarized affidavit to be opened by his family after he died. He died in 2005. Now, his family didn't rush to bring this out to the public or anything. They waited around, and his two writers, I forgot their names, they wrote a book, Witness to Roswell. And they printed his affidavit in that book. And he goes out to explain everything that he knew. He saw the craft in the hangar. He saw the bodies being prepared for shipment. And he explains mostly what you heard about Roswell is, Major Marcel went out to the debris field, collected him and Sheridan Cabot, the CIC agent, counterintelligence corps agent, brought the material, but they couldn't load in their cars. They brought it back to the base, but Marcel brought it to his home first, so to his family before he brought it to the base where he knew it would become classified. So, and it says that right the next day when they brought the thing, all that material to the base, that it's said that prior to that, when Mac Brazel, the rancher that brought the debris found on his ranch out there in Corona, New Mexico, he brought it to the sheriff's office. The sheriff called the base, and they sent Marcel and the CIC agent out there. They decided, yeah, this strange stuff needs to be investigated, and they went out to the ranch with Brazel, and they brought it back. And then it says Marcel was sent to Carswell Air Force Base to show the material to General Ramey. Well, according to Walter Hout, his affidavit, Ramey came to Roswell that same morning, and they had a big meeting with all the major officers, personnel at Roswell, or at this meeting, including Walter Hunt. They showed the material to all these people. Ramey saw it. They handled it. They couldn't explain. They didn't know what it was. So Ramey already saw this stuff before. It says Marcel brought it to Fort Worth to show General Ramey. And then Ramey they laid the stuff out in Ramey's office, and then Ramey brought Marcel into this map room on the back to pinpoint on the map exactly where the debris field was. Well, actually, when they came back into the office, the material that they had spread out on the floor had been replaced by a torn up weather balloon and a radar reflector used to track the balloon. And made Ramey look like a fool because they claimed, oh, that's when they brought in, they took pictures, they had the photographer take pictures, and they had the weather officer come in, identify the material. Oh, that's just a weather balloon and a radar reflector. So it made Marcel look like an idiot because he couldn't recognize
absolutely
the degree of a weather balloon. But,
let me ask you this. With the recent disappointment over the DNI report on the Tic Tac and other UAPs, do you sense we'll ever have real disclosure?
Yeah, I predicted in the first book that it's going to happen. And I didn't expect it to happen for another two or three decades, another 10, 20, 30 years. But the fact that last year it started coming out there with, the guy that from the...
Luis Elizondo?
Alessandro, yeah. Now, he was able to get these videos from the Pentagon, and it went public. He put it in the public domain, and since then, so a few other videos have yes. come out. Mm-hmm. So the disclosure is coming. But I think the real part of the disclosure, the major part of disclosure, probably won't be revealed for a long time, because I believe, from what I've, all the information that I've accrued, and I make no claims that any of this is true. I see throughout the book, I'm presenting evidence that suggests this or that, but evidence does not necessarily constitute proof. I leave it up to the reader to judge the information based on its merits and form their own opinions and conclusions. But I think the major part of disclosure has to do with the a religious aspect, and especially in the biblical part. Because if the government is working with aliens, I'm sure they probably know what was going on during the biblical era. And if that information was released, it would blow religions out of the water all over the world. And that's something they can't do at this time. It would create too many problems in the world. And you know how fanatical some people are today about their religious beliefs. And if that information was released, it's going to be released at a time when people will have already come to accept that information as common knowledge. And I don't think that's going to happen for a very long time yet.
My guest is Alan A.R. Roberts. His book, From Atom to Omega, An Anatomy of UFO Phenomenon. Alan, one more time, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you.
Okay. It's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and almost any other book site on the internet. You can either bring it up, even China, Japan, Australia, and a lot of places in Europe, South America. You learn a lot more about me on my website, arroberts.net. And I've got some pictures on there, some reviews and whatnot. So you can get a pretty good idea of where I'm coming from if you go to the website.
From Atom to Omega, an amazing compendium of research and detail. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor, the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.